Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today.
And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. I'd like to thank them for their generous support. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and is part of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. Our program, along with all of our programs, are streaming live at wvlp.org. Art on the Air is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. Our entire show archive can be heard at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. Our shows are carried by Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., and you can hear them at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And now a very special musical treat during the pandemic from Billy and Renee Foster, their new song called Virus.
Corona, Corona, stay at home.
Billy and Renee Foster, their new song called Virus. And we'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight, Phil Potemka from Theater at the Center. And he's going to tell us a little bit about what's going on there and at the Center for Visual Performing Arts. Phil, welcome
hello.
To this.
Hello,
and hello to your listeners.
Well, tell us a little bit about, we understand this whole pandemic thing is obviously impacting performances at Theater at the Center. And tell us how that's impacting that and the building as a whole.
It certainly is. And you know, this year 2020 marks our 30th anniversary season. And Esther and Larry, you know, we wanted it to be one that our patrons would never forget and be memorable, but not certainly in this way that it's unfolded. We started out strong with our first show, which was the John Denver tribute. It was John Denver's America. It ran, you know, a 6-week run. Great, right up until, right, ironically, March the 13th, which is Friday the 13th. And we had to close early because of the pandemic and the governor's shelter in and for the safety of performers and patrons. So we lost the last week of that first main stage show. And then, of course, had to cancel all of the special events and concerts because we do a lot of other programming here at the Performing Arts Center and in, you know, 1040 Ridge Road here in Munster. And then our spring show, we were hopeful we might be able to do Talia's Folly as a Pulitzer Prize-winning play. That was to be April and May, and unfortunately the same thing. We weren't able to do it just because, again, everybody was following a shelter-in, advising social distancing. And even though it was a two-person play, it just was not able to be performed because we want to make sure our subscribers feel comfortable and can enjoy the experience. And the latest, and you have it first before everybody else, that takes us to spring, now summer. Our summer performance, Ain't Misbehaving, a five-person musical, the music of Fats Waller, great 1930s set, you know, with music. And that is our July-August summer show, and we're going to have to postpone that as well. Just because of the fact that patrons tend to be a little older, and we want to make sure that we know exactly what our numbers are like and that things are safe and we can have our infrastructure in place. So, you know, we'll see if we get that pushback a little closer to fall. And, of course, our season subscribers have been great, and we know that we will make amends and either get them a credit or a refund, whatever they desire. And, you know, we're going to keep plodding along and look to fall and the holidays for the theater side.
Very good. Hey, having worked in the center there for 6 years myself, that's got to be kind of a lonesome place when you go in there with all the other things there. Joe Trauma's catering operation, South Shore Arts, and everything else.
So true. You're right. You know, I always call this the oasis of arts and culture because art galleries, the symphony is based here with their headquarters. And then Chef Joe Trauma has the wonderful champagne brunch and the weddings and dining events, which have kind of been, no pun intended, on the back burner. An update for you on South Shore Art. There's not anything open in the atrium gallery. There's nothing on the walls right now. But hopefully that, you know, Governor Holcomb has said that cultural events, entertainment venues can open up beginning the weekend of June 13th and 14th. So South Shore Art plans to come back on the 15th. They have that great gift shop. Get the gallery open, which is where they have the exhibit currently running, Where the Wild Things Are. That wonderful storybook tale of all the exhibit and the original illustrations are on display, and they've extended that through September. And then Chef Joe Trauma is still doing his carryout meals, which works on Sundays, fantastic price, different menu every week. You just go to visit www.cdpa.org for all those menus. And eventually one day we'll be clinking champagne glasses and we hope for brunch to return. And then lastly, the symphony, of course, you know, John Kane and the maestro have to cancel all the summer outdoor park concerts. And so now the eye is on the ball for what can happen in September. So stay tuned for our symphony.
You know, how is this pandemic impacting you personally in terms of, I know you're still writing, of course, the articles, and I just read your most recent one, but tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you have to be a little creative as a columnist when you cover arts and entertainment and dining and hotel and travel when you're not doing any of the above. And I've certainly been in the business for 24 years, and I have a lot of memories, a lot of those chronicles and those cookbooks that we've talked about in the past.
I know,
but nobody wants to read. Nobody wants to just read a column about memories. So it had me be a little more creative. But there's still a lot of things to write about. You know, I wrote about the drive-in theater in Valparaiso, and it was closed, and patrons were worried. And hey, the scoop is going to be that it's opening in June. If they saw the column, they're going to get it reopened again. They had a death in the family, so there's still things to be written about. And most of all, as you, Esther, and Larry both know, I try to make sure there's a balance of good news out there because, boy, we've had enough of the heavy stuff.
Boy, we sure have. It's been
Well, it would seem like, though, the cookbooks would be the perfect time because everybody's cooking so much more now.
That is true. Thank you for mentioning those From the Farm cookbooks are based on my farm columns. Those columns are fine to do because I'm pretty much sequestered in at the family farm near Valparaiso. So plenty to write about and test out cooking with those From the Farm cookbooks that are out there. There's four of them now, so there's plenty to do with those, but yeah, the entertainment columns are a little more challenging, but hey, they're still happening.
Maybe you should do an online cooking thing for people, you know, as an extension of your books.
Yeah, that's true. Right from the kitchen, right? In real time. Right now, if you want to know what we're doing, we're cutting asparagus, we're cutting rhubarb, and we're about to pick some very tart gooseberries on the bushes that are ready.
You know, we have just a few more seconds left, Phil. Tell us a little bit about what you project for Theater at the Center in the fall, maybe.
Well, have Hello Dolly scheduled for our fall show. That could be a little ambitious because it's a big cast. And we have to think of our equity performers because they're all union. We got to keep them safe and follow those new guidelines, taking temperatures, social distancing. So maybe, again, we first postpone and push back Ain't Misbehavin' in the five-member musical. Start with that and then see where we go for maybe one of these larger scale productions.
Well, I appreciate you coming on Art in the Air for this spotlight. That's Phil Potempa from Theater at the Center and also with his great books. Thank you coming on the show, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
My pleasure. Anytime. Please stay safe and well and to your listeners, too.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And our guest on Art in the Air is Laura Marie Pinozzo. She's an eco-art person, creates from found objects, art from all over, and she's based in Northwest Indiana. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Hello.
Thank you. Aloha and hello. Buongiorno.
Well, Laura, we'd like you to tell our audience just a little bit about your origin story, where you came from, and kind of like how you got from where you were to where you are now.
This is an interesting story.
That's always a good thing. Interesting is good these days. We need interesting. So I was born and raised in La Porte, Indiana, and I am a twin. I have a fraternal twin. Her name is Marie. I had dark brown hair, and Marie had blonde hair. And we were polar opposites growing up. She was very intellectual and very brilliant and smart. And I was very creative and very nature-based and just kind of doing my own thing, you know? And after high school, I gravitated away from La Porte. I went to Chicago. I started off at Columbia College. I was studying theater and was in soap operas, and that was my concentration. And shortly after I was in a few soap operas, one Christmas I was walking past the Utrecht Art Store, and I saw this beautiful picture. It was like a gorgeous fresco. It was huge. It was black and gold, and it was of the Virgin Mary. And I had to walk across the street to just see it up close, and I stood there, and I thought, I am going to paint. I need to, like, actually paint. I need to try and paint because I feel like I can paint. And so I went into the store, and I bought all my painting supplies. I had no idea what I was even doing, just grabbing random paintbrushes and colors, and we get a couple, few canvases. And I bought it, and I took all that stuff to my little apartment there, and I just started painting, and I could paint. I found out that I could really paint, and I was, like, shocked, and I was amazed, and I went, and I changed my major. I changed my major to painting, and then I decided I wanted to change my school. So I made a portfolio for the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and I gave it to them, and they accepted my portfolio, and I even got a scholarship, which paid almost a full ride of my entire college career.
Wow. So what was that first painting of, Laura?
It was of the Virgin Mary. Yeah, I still have it today. It's the one painting or sculpture, you know, I've always sold everything ever that I've always made. And it's the one thing that I actually have.
You know, one thing, before we skip ahead on your art, I'd like to get back to theater. Tell us a little bit about what you did in theater and what your interests were in theater before you switched to visual arts.
So I, you know, being an Italian-American, my dad immigrated from Calabria, Italy. And his uncle, you know, my uncle Tony, he was a person of, like, super coolness during the 1940s and 50s. He was, like, the old school, like, Godfather movie cool, you know, he had that whole era to him. And my dad kind of, like, lived as a kid underneath that era, you know. And my family was all steel workers, and everybody came from that immigrated part of life on my dad's side of the family. And they all grew up in Gary, Indiana. And pairing, you know, the combination of my background with that time frame of being a young person growing and watching my dad come from that culture. You know, there was the Frank Sinatra, there was the opera. We always listened to opera. We always listen to Pavarotti. It's just like everything we love so much. And it was music and it was theater. I mean, anytime we sat down at the dinner table, it was theater. You know, no one could talk about going to the grocery store or buying a tomato without being theatrical. Like, if the tomato was great, it was way beyond great. It was amazing. It was, you know, it was exhausting talking about how wonderful the tomato was. It was like everything was so over-exaggerated my whole life from my dad's side that theater was like a natural love, you know.
So you said about you were in soap operas and performed. So tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I did it. It was like, it was based through Columbia College, and there were new writers that were coming on from a film company at this time was called Abraxas Films. And, I just was like, no, I'll do that. I want to go and try that out. Let me take this script and I'll read about it and then I'll just show up and do it. So I did, and I read the script and I played this part of this crazy villain named Josephine. And we had filmed the entire movie, and I got the part. It was like a soap opera, you know, I tried out for it, and I was like, yeah, you got it, it was great. We filmed this entire movie. It was so sinister, and it was so cool. And then the production manager, the guy who was helping, you know, produce the entire film, his wife left him and ran off with all of his money.
A soap opera right there.
Yeah, it stopped abruptly. And so we were all so excited. The film was going to be produced, and we were so ready, and everyone. And then this big bombshell hit, and everything was over. So I, you know, it was kind of like an inspired, natural, you know, force of nature and like the divine that my path curved. And it went to the art world. Like, you know, it was also natural within me, and I didn't even know it was, you know.
Very good. And did you appear in musicals at all? Or?
So, no, I didn't appear in musicals, but if I would have stayed with it, I sure would have. You know, I just loved it. I would be the person to go jump on Broadway. You know, if I would have followed my career path, calling in the beginning of theater in that manner, I would have done so.
Very good. Well, let's move on to your art, because you're an eco-sculptor. So kind of explain what that is and what that means.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone is reinventing terms these days. It's like we're no longer living in the same world that we were, you know, 3 months ago. So I think the best way to just describe an eco-sculptor myself is I give myself that title because to me, eco means just everything that I can do to save our planet. All of the things that I make my sculptures from are waste. You know, they're like garbage. They're recycled plastics. They are recycling bin items, you know. So the bust sculptures, the Renaissance bust sculptures, that's all garbage. The understructure is all trash. It's all trash that, you know, destroys the earth. We have these plastic ions in the air we breathe because there's so much plastic, you know. So plastic, you know, either is destroyed by me via recreation because I reinvent it and I turn it into something beautiful. If it's going to be on our earth for 1,000 years, it might as well be repurposed into some, like, beautiful work of art, you know, like an avenue of spirit rather than trash that would just destroy the earth.
Yeah, it's already produced. It's a really valid understructure for the sculpture.
Yeah, and it's very, you know, when you start doing something that makes no sense to many people, you start to learn a different level of intelligence. And my whole level of intelligence from using trash as my sculpture is that, you know, we are all vessels. You know, I like to use these large Gatorade bottles that are empty. They make, like, fabulous, strong bases for the understructure. I have to put like 4 or 5 or even 10 or 20 of them together with duct tape. They form this like amazing core. And the core is trash. Once I'm done with the sculpture, all those empty bottles are filled with something. And it is literally like spirit. It's like filled with spirit, and it takes on this form, and it is this person, and it is this beautiful faith, or it is, you know, the Virgin Mary, or it's this guardian angel, or it's this Mother Earth that evolves straight out of ground. It's like those things are real. They're like the divine, or they're like our ancestors. They're our ancestry, our inherited bloodline. They're the human element, the human soul, and it's all garbage.
I also see you use a lot of natural things in your work, it looks like driftwood and things like that. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, for sure. That stuff, that driftwood, it's driftwood, yes. You know, it's also fallen wood that just like falls naturally in the forest. It's anything that crossed my path that is in front of me that is literally going to be like burned. You know, it's either firewood or something that nobody's ever going to like love or use. It'll just sit there and it'll mold and it'll grow moss and it'll deteriorate mm-hmm. without a second life. But, you know, I see things when I use the wood and all this fallen wood and the driftwood. I actually see what it's going to be when it's on the forest floor or when I find it on the beach. Like, I look at it and I see this head of a phoenix. I know that is it. You know,
don't you think it's like looking at the clouds? There are some people who see things in the clouds, and I feel the same way about when I see a piece of driftwood. There's eyes. I mean, there's such beautiful eyes and faces already in them.
It is. And, you know, that's the other thing. If people would slow down enough to just observe something without any objective, people would realize that there's so much to be seen. You know, there was a scientific study put out that says we as human beings don't see everything around us. In fact, our perception gates see about 10%. And that's it.
Minimal.
That means we're missing all of the spirits, we're missing all of the angels, we're missing all these beautiful things that are in front of us, but we don't see it because our perception is so limited.
You know, something I don't want to miss, Laura, is some of your travels with your art, I guess going overseas like in 1998. And tell us a little bit about that, Florence and all the other places you've been for exhibits and things before coming back here.
Yeah, that was such a fun time. That was just wild and wonderful. That opportunity came to me via the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And I think it was my junior year. Yeah, well, my sophomore year. I think it was my sophomore year. It was my sophomore year going into my junior year, and they had offered a semester abroad, and the semester was going to be in Florence, Italy. And of course, you know, I had never been to Italy and loved Italy, and I speak Italian growing up. And my dad's family was from the very south of Italy. It was like the toe of the boot of, you know, the country of Italy. It's like the Straits of Sicily, you know, Calabria, right there. And I went with the impression, happily, that I would be there for my one semester of 3 months. I would study at the Italian university, and I would come back, you know, to Chicago, refreshed and in touch with my roots, and a better person and a better artist because of it. And I went, and I could not leave. I just fell completely in love with Italy. I could speak the language. You know, the church bells would ring through the old town of Florence. It was like small and beautiful, and all the works of art that I'd ever loved so much were right there. And I was just in love, and I could not move. And I stayed there for 5 years. And I love that city. And the friends I made then are still my dear friends now. I mean, we have not missed a day in each other's lives in all that time. Just beautiful to have my home of my cultural heritage from my father's side be my actual home in the real world in this beautiful country of Italy. It's like to have that as my second home. It is such a precious gift. And It would have never come to me ever had I never not walked across that street to look at the picture of the Madonna that I was so called to. It's just, I love what happened to me in that time frame. You know, I just love it so very much.
Well, you left Italy and went to Puerto Rico. So tell us about that transition there, Laura.
Yeah, so this is very interesting. I love the story of Puerto Rico, too. It is very much connected to the spiritual bust and sculpture work I do. Like if I make a bust of Jesus Christ, or at the Virgin Mary. You know, my Virgin Mary has a unicorn in her arms because that's me, and I'm funny like that. But the spiritual artwork, you know, that I do is blessed by Puerto Rico because when I was studying at University Bacci in Florence, Italy, I met a really wonderful friend, and this person was from Puerto Rico, and they were a sculpture artist as well. And I took an invitation after the time I had spent in Italy to go and visit in Puerto Rico, and I did love it. I went and I knew I was being called to go and stay. So I actually went and stayed, ended up 4 years in Puerto Rico. I studied an independent study of the art of San Pedro, which is the art of carving saints out of wood. It is really beautiful, and it has a long and rich history, particularly in Puerto Rico. I was a professor there at the Museum of Art in Puerto Rico. I did that for 3.5 years. Just fabulous. The amount of like magic that I came in contact with in Puerto Rico was amazing. And so those 4 years helped transfer, you know, in many different ways, my love of both Mediterranean and, you know, Latin, and all through the times of like the 1200s through the 1500s, 1600s period, I am just so moved by the sculpture of that time. And having studied it in the Caribbean under that independent study, it was like reliving another part of my life that I didn't even know existed. It was like connecting with a past life of something I'd always known and had been knowing of, but didn't know until I actually arrived on that piece of earth, you know?
Well, you're certainly a master of listening to your inner voice and the nature that calls to you. It's really beautiful.
That's the best compliment ever, Esther. Thank you. I always try to tell my children, I say this, you have to always listen to the first voice that you hear. You know, that's always your intuition. That is always the right choice. It's the right voice. And, you know, it's also your guardian angel, too. That voice of intuition is love. It's love from the divine. It's a gift. And when you hear it, you have to listen to it.
Now, Laura, you returned for a while to Florence to study mask making. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I studied under this wonderful guy named Agostino Dessi, and he's a super famous, you know, Florentine mask maker. Also, I think, like, the mask part, you know, of working with the paper mache, which is essentially what it is, that also helped me to understand how to make the sculptures that I'm making now out of trash, you know, come into form. Because, you know, with these masks, the old tradition is just the dried paper and the paper pages and the paper leaves, if you will, then, you know, posted with the glue, you know, and then shaped into form. You add more papers and you add more glue if you want to sculpt a face, or you keep it flat and simple if you want to leave it plain. You know, it's like it introduced me to the medium of working with, you know, a recyclable.
And you're exhibiting, and I mean, I was looking at your exhibit resume and CV all over, but locally, where have you exhibited in Northwest Indiana, Chicago area?
Yeah, so there's been so many different places.
I know. One
is the Lebesnik Center, which I love so much. I've exhibited at the Lebesnik Center. Gosh, there's been so many different group shows. Chicago.
And you had your own storefront on Franklin Street.
Yeah, and I did. I have my own gallery and own storefront on Franklin Street, downtown there, in Michigan City, in the Uptown Arts District. And, you know, I All around.
Public sculpture in La Porte as well.
Yeah, so yeah, there is a it's about 12 feet tall wooden phoenix. It's just huge, enormous, and beautiful. And the city of La Porte bought that from me for one of their parks. We're not sure if it's going to go in Unity Park by the boat launch there on Pine Lake Avenue, or if they're going to put it in a different park or a nature park. But we'll be looking forward to see where that's going to go. We should know probably sometime this summer.
Now, where can people see your things online? I think you have an Etsy site and a few other places.
Yeah, so I really love Instagram, and I'm Laura Marie Panazzo at Instagram. You know, I'm on the fence about making a website. It seems like there's so much information out there already with the Medium platform. But you can find me there. Yeah, I shortly here after next month, I'll be on Amazon. And so there'll be YouTube and Amazon to add to those three platforms.
Very good. Now, do you take commissions?
I do. I take commissions. I take commissions all the time. And I work with any budget. I've made some precious, endearing gifts for some really special people for a good price. And I once turned a baby dresser into a bird. That was really fun. I took all the drawers of this precious baby dresser that meant a lot to this family, and I sliced it all up and put it into a bird form. And I like to do heirloom work, you know, if there's creative thinkers out there that want something really special, I love to do that kind of, you know, heirloom reinvention work. And I take all kinds of commissions. Yeah.
You know, I just want to briefly touch on the pandemic as going on. How's that influenced you as an artist? Has it been a negative impact, or have you been more creative?
Well, for me, you know, it was a little bit of both. It is still a little bit of both. I am a super, you know, empathetic person, and I'm really sensitive, you know. There's a tough cookie shell and then really soft on the inside. And the first half of this pandemic has sent me into tears constantly and tremendous worry. And I really had kind of like a writer's block in terms of creativity. I just kind of balled up and I struck out really good. I just, you know, it was really difficult for me. And then I was like, okay, well, enough of this. This is really not how I want to be living, especially if it's in a pandemic. So then I refocused myself, kind of changed my perspective, and the creativity came, you know, really kind of rushing back. There's a lot of real deep-seated things that made me feel so overwhelmed and sad. I kind of turned into a more of a loving emotional platform that was more like spiritually connected, you know. So I kind of moved out of the sadness, but, you know, as the days go by, it's just now sad again.
Very interesting, Laura. Well, that's Laura Marie Panazzo, and she's an eco sculptor. We appreciate you being on Art on the Air and telling us all about your work.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I was so excited to share everything. I just love the platform, and I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Esther.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And now we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air, Ginny Rabstad. She's an award-winning keynote speaker, comedian, seminar presenter, and very early in her career, she delighted audience performing stand-up comedy in all the major comedy clubs in the greater Los Angeles area. Welcome to the show.
Aloha, Ginny.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Well, first off, let's just find out a little bit about you, where you grew up, and like I like to say, where you started and how you got from where you are to now from where you were.
Well, I grew up in Salinas, California, which is the home of John Steinbeck, the author, and Iceberg Lettuce. And I discovered that I liked being funny when I was in high school, and I became very involved in the shows at school. But I really enjoyed getting a laugh. So I found that that was sort of a talent that I had. And eventually I moved to Los Angeles to try to further my acting career. And I ended up seeing a show by Phyllis Diller at Knott's Berry Farm. And she got one laugh after another laugh. I'm telling you, my sides were hurting. For the first time in my life, I understood that expression, die laughing. I really thought, you got to stop now. You're killing me. But I said, I want that. I would like to have a show and go and perform for an audience that appreciates me like that. And so I began to start writing sketches. And, of course, I started out in the open mics in the Los Angeles market, and they were all over the place back then. I haven't been there in years. I'm still sure they're still there. But eventually I got a gig at the Natural Fudge Company, which is a vegetarian restaurant, and they gave me a half-hour show. So I had to fill it this time. You know, I said, sure, I'll take the job. And then I went, you got to write some more material. And so I started the idea of coming up with characters. And two of the characters that I've been doing in my show to this day, Gladys Stumpf, who is the 85-year-old lady who wants to have a date, and Sacagawea were from my early sketches. And I wrote them because I knew at one point in my life I would be probably an older lady looking for love, and because I absolutely adored Sacagawea, her contribution to our history and her great accomplishment being on the Lewis and Clark expedition. And from the get-go, it was one of my favorite, the audience favorites. They just loved it, too. So those started in the very early days, and they traveled with me until I started, you know, actually doing my show in present day. And I've done my show now in 7 states, and I've done a couple of two-hour shows, one in California and a couple of two-hour shows here at Paul Henry's Art Gallery here in Hammond. But ordinarily speaking, I'm booked for an hour program, and so I do about 7 or 8 sketches.
And you have a whole wide variety of these characters that are your stock characters, and you also do and you also do storytelling too.
Yes, I do. And the latest foray into storytelling is a true story based on my great great grandmother who survived the Great Chicago Fire. I have a cousin who is the family historian, and he did a lot of the research on this, and then I took it and I went into, you know, the encyclopedias and learned a few more things. But one of the great things about this story that I'm going to tell you, just sort of in capsule here, is that my great-great-grandmother, Bridget Ryan Callahan, lived a fairly long time, and so my grandfather and Jim, who's my cousin, who is the family historian, his mother got to talk to her, and they learned a lot about her life, and so it was really wonderful for me to get this information, because I don't know if you have a family album full of people that you know is your great aunt this or your great grandfather, but you have absolutely no idea what these people were like, what they thought about, how they felt about things, what their hobbies were, their philosophy of life, just a space. And I decided at some point in my life I wanted to learn who these people were. So I, you know, having Jim as a fountain of information. So if you don't mind, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my great-grandmother. She was a young wife and mother living across the street from Pat and Kate O'Leary on the night of the Great Chicago Fire. So those of you who know anything about the fire history, it started in the barn at 137 DeCoven Street, which was a block north of 12th Street in Chicago. So the fire started, and the neighbors came out, and they were sort of standing around watching it like people do, and then all it became very, very clear. This was the fire from hell. This was not just a little fire that the firemen were going to come and put out. So my great-grandmother was at home alone with her children because her husband, Michael, who was known as Mick, was working in LaPorte, Indiana at the time. So I'm just going to backspace a little bit here and give you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of my great-grandmother. She was born in 1841 in County Limerick, Ireland. And those of you who know the history of Ireland know that that is the beginning of the Great Potato Famine, which raged and, you know, devastated Ireland through the mid-40s. And her father died, and so her mother decided that she was going to send Bridget to America with her father's brother. And so off they went. And then later, Bridget's mother remarried, and they settled in the U.S. too. But Bridget took a job as a housemaid in the family in Brooklyn. She was there for quite a while. Whereas my great-grandfather, Mick, he was born in 1834 in County Galway, and he immigrated to America in the 1850s and settled in Brooklyn. And he was a very hard-working guy, and he was doing his best to be successful. And as we know, the American Civil War started in 1861. So on the last day of 1863, Mick became a U.S. citizen. So by March of 1864, he was enlisted as a private in the 13th New York Heavy Artillery Unit, Company G. And in the course of his service, he was issued a single-shot sharp carbine rifle and a pack of 50-caliber bullets. And this rifle will play a part in Bridget's story on the night of the Great Chicago Fire. After the war, Mick returns to Brooklyn. He meets Bridget, and they get married. And he learns of employment opportunities in Chicago, so he moves the family there in 1867. By this time, they had three young children, Andrew, age 3, Daisy, 2, and 4-month-old Winnie. And that 4-month-old baby, Winnie, was my great-grandmother. So we'll talk some more about her in a while. But on the night of the fire, as I said, Bridget was home alone with the children, and the fire broke out about 8:30. Well, Bridget looks at this, and she knows we are in serious trouble. So she takes the sharp carbine rifle, and she has the baby in one arm, and she marches those two little toddlers to 12th Street and over to Lake Michigan. So she's protecting her children in the water and praying all night that somehow Mick is going to find them. Well, on the night of the fire, Mick was working as a lineman for the Western Union Telegraph Company, and he was staying at a railroad section camp in LaPorte, Indiana. And shortly after midnight, the work crew received a telegram informing them of the inferno that was enveloping Chicago. And so they looked across Lake Michigan. They could see the glow of the fire. Two of Mick's neighbors were part of the crew he was working with, and so frantic, these three men commandeered a hand-crank railroad car and set out for Chicago over 60 miles away. And they eventually got there by the afternoon of the 9th. And so Mick goes looking for the family. The house they were living in is a pile of ash. And a neighbor who was passing through trying to inspect his own property said, "I've seen Bridget and the children. They're down at the lake on the base of 12th Street." So Mick ran down there, and the family was reunited. So, of course, they had lost everything like so many Chicagoans, and they just had to start over. But within days, fortunately, relief efforts in the form of money and food and clothing started coming into Chicago from all over the region. And Mick found work clearing away the fire debris and loading and unloading building materials. My great-great-grandfather was a very hard-working guy, and he never shied away from any kind of work. He knew that's what he had to do. But the problem was, where were they going to live? Because it was one thing to live through the fire, but how are you going to survive the fire is the next thing. As you know, October, heading into the cold season. But they started rebuilding the wooden sidewalk on what is now Wacker Dry. And so Mick, he took a, bound some canvas, and he put it on top of the sidewalk, and he made a dugout. So they had a canvas floor, and he dug out this structure for them to live in. And so he worked 10, 12 hours a day, you know, cleaning up the city, and Bridget was in the dugout taking care of the kids. And they had, somehow he had salvaged a big iron kettle that they burned wood in to keep warm. But they got a lot of their meals from the relief committee. That was good for her. So by the spring of 1872, Mick took employment in the Union Stockyards, and he moved the family into housing in the Back of the Yards neighborhood. You've probably heard of that. But eventually, they went on to be successful. They had four more children, and Mick bought them a brick home where they lived for the rest of their lives. So because of her courage, you know, her children and their children lived to sing her praises. And as I said, my great-grandmother was little baby Winnie. And she had six children, and her second child and the oldest of her four sons was my grandfather, Walter Mahoney. So that's how the Callahans and the Mahoneys formed my clan. But the interesting thing was is that Sharp's carbine rifle remained in the family until it was sold to a Civil War memorabilia collector in 1950, 86 years after it had been issued to Private Mick Callahan of Company G. And 79 years after his brave wife, Bridget, used it to protect her children on the night of the Great Chicago Fire.
Did it go to a private collector or is it in a museum?
No, it was a private collector, and there's some of the descendants that are sorry that that happened, but at the time, my grand aunt Winnie, who my grandfather's sister, said, "I don't want this thing in my house." So there you go.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
Now, you're also involved with Toastmasters. Tell us a little bit about doing that.
I'm a longtime Toastmaster because I needed a club, an organization that really encouraged me to speak. You know, see, I am not one of these reticent people, and sometimes you find yourself in a group of people, and they say, "Jeannie, okay. But these people actually said, "Speak and teach and go forth and, you know, win prizes and stuff." And so I became very involved in competitive speaking. I won like 24 first place and about 6 second place. And so as a result, people began to start asking me, "Could you coach me?" And that started my coaching business.
Boy, that rigid spirit runs strong in you.
The what?
The rigid spirit runs strong in you.
I think so, actually. This story is going to find its way into my show in one form or another because it's fairly new piece, but when I present it, people find that so interesting because I guess we're in, you know, in the neighborhood where a lot of people's, you know, relatives remember some aspect of it. But that'll be entering my show as well. But the thing that I would like to mention to your public out there, your listening public, is that I'm starting a new Toastmasters Club at Purdue Commercialization and Manufacturing Excellence Center that is going to be directed toward the entrepreneurial community, including inventors from the community and student inventors from Purdue and small business owners. I'm a small business owner, and everything in this club is directed toward helping people get seed money to start their businesses. So you're probably aware that there are pitch competitions where the inventors sell their product and to a panel of judges, and then they win money. And fortunately, I'm happy to say that one of my clients that I coach privately won $3,500 last year in one competition, $4,000 in another, and this year he won $10,000. So I'm really happy that, you know, my work is being, paid attention to, and he totally appreciates the work that I've done for him. So I took it one step further, and now I'm teaching other people and coaching other people privately that are launching webinars and that are competing in other competitions down the road. So I would like to invite anybody who's interested, who's a small business owner, who's interested in, you know, sort of hanging with people that are other small business owners and can help each other learn to get funding opportunities, to take that extra step. I'd really like to invite them to come. We're meeting the second, fourth Thursdays at Purdue CMAC, and we'll be back in the space on July the 9th. Right now we're meeting online. So if anybody is interested, they can contact me at jeannierafted@gmail.com.
So will the online be available even when you're meeting in person?
Yes, we're trying to make this a hybrid club. So that means that we will have people online from wherever they are simultaneously while we're meeting in the space.
That's perfect.
And you can find out also at jeannierafted.com. So your website also has links to things like that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate that.
You know, one thing I was thinking of, I'm a graduate of Leadership Northwest Indiana, which is now under the guise of the Leader Institute at Purdue. And that might be something you might want to connect to also, because that's a whole bunch of people that take that for the equivalent of a semester. It's not a college class, but they are leaders that were emerging leaders. And I went through it in the 90s. But, yeah, that might be something beneficial for you to be one of their speakers. They have a whole variety of speakers over the six-month period.
Actually, they invited me. The Purdue University's Northwest Leadership Institute Young Leaders Academy invited me. So I'll be presenting my Laugh and Learn workshop online on June the 10th at 1 p.m. to their audience. So I'm very interested in that. And that's a program similar only – well, it's similar in the sense that it's a speaker's workshop, but I do the same thing for businesses, you know, a 50-minute laugh and learn. But this is directed toward those sophomores and junior high school audience. So I'm really looking forward to that. I was invited to present it at Highland High School this past fall, and I really enjoyed it a lot. So when they asked me to present here for the Young Leaders Academy, I said, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And I'm really interested in doing this to anybody who has a youth organization, church youth organization, private or public high school. If you're interested in me presenting my Laugh and Learn workshop, just let me know, and I'll be there.
Now, I'd like to talk to you about some of your characters, and maybe we can show a sample of it. Why don't you set up the one character that we'll give a sample of from your, well, it's actually from your YouTube video about your sample, but this is a Viking.
Yeah, Sonia the Fierce is my great-great-great etc. grandmother, Rapstead. And this character talks about how she and her husband came to the United States for the first time. And it's absolutely hilarious. I tried to use as many factual things as I could, but it's basically, you know, nonsense. And she's a warrior woman, and she's very, very a strong personality, and her husband not so much.
So here's the Viking from Jeannie Rabstag's show.
I am Jeannie's great, 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 etc. grandmother, Sonia the Fierce. People call me that because my name is Sonia, and I'm fierce. I am a warrior woman. You heard that expression, 1,000 Swedes ran through the weeds, chased by one Norwegian? That was me!
Okay, and we're back. That was a great character. Tell us a little bit about your characters. What characters you do in one of your stand-up shows?
Actually, I really like Gladys Stump. She is, as I said, one of the first ones that I wrote back in the Hollywood days. But she is, the older I get, the more I, you know, fit into sort of her. And what she is she's an older lady looking for love. And I had to update her over time because when I wrote this is when people wrote to the Lovelorn columns in the back of magazines. And now she's looking for love on eHarmony.com. I also like the one that is know-it-all Nanette. And I ask my audience if any of them are know-it-alls. And some people actually admit to it. But anyway, I like her. She talks about how people who are involved in know-it-allism doing this, you know, for your benefit so that you can become a better person. I generally get a lot of laughs on that one, too.
A personal favorite, or does that shift with as you?
Yeah, actually, my favorite sketch that I wrote, and actually I won an award for it in a regional speech competition, was Sacagawea. I really, really, as I told you before we started the taping, she is one of my favorite characters of all time, one of the most beloved American ladies that we've, you know, here in North American ladies. And I really like her a lot, and she is the wisdom in the Lewis and Clark story, and the laugh lines fall on Lewis and Clark and her husband, Toussaint Charbonneau, and she's the voice of wisdom. And actually, it's really true.
Yeah, she was leading them when she was pregnant and then actually had a baby en route and leading them.
She had you know, the little baby Baptiste, which was the only child that she ever had. But, yes, so here she was with this foolish husband, and she's leading the way. And so I talk about in the story and about how the decisions that she made really helped them out, because she was only 16, but she was sort of the brains of the outfit.
Well, and also I think is she ran into her tribe, and that could have been bad for them, but because she was with them, it protected them.
Yes, and that wasn't the only time that she protected them, because, you know, she had been captured, so she was could speak more than one of the native tongue. And so when they ran into other tribes, she was able to meet with them and, you know, smooth things over for them by, you know, convincing them that this party meant absolutely no harm to them. And so she was really a tremendous asset, and I fell in love with her story when I was growing up as a kid, and then I thought to myself, I would like to add another historical character to my show because I had written her way back in the Hollywood days. And so I brought her into the show, and people just loved her. And then, you know, I had my great-grandmother. But the rest of the characters that I perform are sort of contemporary. And I talk about growing up in Salinas, California. That's a story that I think Esther may have heard. But it leads into a humorous story called The Cowboy. You know how we women, we have this fantasy about cowboys? I relive this fantasy through this sketch, and it ends with a surprise. I really love delivering the ending of that because I never know how the audience is going to react. And so it's kind of fun for me to do that. But basically, right now, the top list of my characters are Dinah and Shelby's love story and Chef Charlotte and Gladys Stump. So I'm hoping to add this story about Bridget Callahan. Did you enjoy the story?
Oh, it's a marvelous, marvelous story, and even more so because it's a true story.
Yep. And you know what? Because Bridget grew up in hard times, she was able to survive that winter of 1871-72 in a dugout. You know, if somebody had come from maybe a more privileged background, I doubt seriously whether they would have fared as well as she did.
Jeannie, we have about a minute left. Tell us how you're surviving the pandemic, how that's impacted you, not only personally, but as a performance artist.
Well, right now, I've been kind of, I haven't really been marketing because nobody's going to hire me. So I've launched a new date. I'm going to start going into full-scale marketing for my show, which is my number one client, are upscale senior residence communities, and as you know, they're closed.
Yes.
So I'm going to start taking bookings for August 1st and after. And then my Laugh and Learn workshop for business speakers, I'll be, you know, marketing that pretty heavily in the next couple of weeks.
When does
the
that
businesses
start again?
Here in Northwest Indiana.
When does that start again?
Yes, I'm just anytime anybody's ready, because the businesses, if they're opening and they want to get their sales team revved up again, perhaps I would be the perfect Laugh and Learn breakfast or Laugh and Learn lunch for them. That's what I generally do. It's a part of a breakfast show or a lunch show. And I could give it any time, like I have it at Green Cow, and I just presented it. But mostly I'm booked for lunchtime or for a breakfast, and so the sales crew comes in, and then they sit and listen and they participate because it's interactive.
Well, Jeannie, we'd like to thank you for being on Art on the Air. You can get a hold of Jeannie at jeannierapstad.com, and you can find out more about her being an award-winning keynote speaker. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jeannie.
Thanks, Jeannie. Well, I love the hat.
Well, I want to thank you so much for inviting me. It was my pleasure.
And we'd like to thank our guests today for being on Art on the Air, which is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m., and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and Walt Brenninger of Paragon Investments. Also, Mary Levan is our art patron supporter. Art on the Air is supported by the Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. See you right here next week, 103.1 FM and 89.1 FM, Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Expression.